On December 18th, 1975, George and Kathy Lutz and their three children moved into a house in Amityville, Long Island. 19 days later, they were running for their lives. What Happened to Them became one of the best-selling books in years and is now a fascinating motion picture, an experience in terror to make you believe in the unbelievable, the Amityville.
There's something in this house, something evil.
The Haunting in Connecticut.
He's here.
It's November 1st, 1971. I'm sitting here with Carolyn Perrin, who, with her family, has been experiencing supernatural occurrences.
You picking up anything in here, hon?
Something awful happened here, Ed.
What is it?
What are you guys?
Well, we've been called ghost hunters, paranormal researchers.
But we prefer to be known simply as Ed and Lorraine Warren.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm your host, Blake Smith. This episode's a little different from anything I've put together before. I'm a big fan of horror films and thrillers. And like a lot of folks, I used to be terrified to hear those chilling words, based on a true story, when a supernatural horror film was being advertised. And even though the so-called true stories often turn out to be less convincing than the case behind them, like, for example, The Exorcist, or a complete fabrication like the events in the film The Changeling, I still like those movies. I recently went to see the film The Conjuring, which is based on a haunting case investigated by the famous, or perhaps infamous, couple Ed and Lorraine Warren. I wanted to do an episode about that case, but I decided instead to look at the Warrens themselves. While I really enjoyed the first third of The Conjuring, the depiction of Ed and Lorraine was as unbelievable to me as the levitating chairs and the flying bedsheets. Now, Ed died in 2006, but Lorraine's still alive and is actively promoting her work and her brand of investigation. For years, I'd been hearing Lorraine talk about the Amityville case, which I found perplexing because, really, the Warrens seemed to have nothing to do with that case. Also, I knew that I'd heard some firsthand stories from paranormal investigator Joe Nickel and also from Steve Novella about their encounters with the Warrens. I thought it might be fun to pull together multiple interviews to give a kind of counterbalance to the way the Warrens are usually depicted, especially to counterbalance the ridiculous, almost saint-like depiction they were given in The Conjuring. In this episode, you'll hear from Joe Nickel, a longtime investigator of the paranormal through scientific methodology. He's written numerous books and is the chief investigator at CSI, the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. You'll also hear from Steve Novella. Steve is a neurologist, a proponent of science-based medicine, and the host of the popular Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast. And we'll hear from Ray Garten, who did an entire episode with us on his experience with the Warrens during the making of In a Dark Place, which later became the film A Haunting in Connecticut. And I interviewed WPIX New York's senior reporter Marvin Scott. Unfortunately, I was not able to get audio from that interview, but I did find a clip in which Marvin gives a neat summary of his experiences with the Warrens at Amityville. So let's start there. For years, I've heard Ed and Lorraine talking about the trauma of their experience at Amityville. But I knew from my own reading and research that they weren't part of the original haunting investigation, nor in the book by Jay Anson. So how did they get involved? In this clip, you'll hear Ed and Lorraine explain exactly how they got involved with the Amityville case.
Monster Talk.
Now, Ed, can you tell me how you and Lorraine got involved in the Amityville horror?
Well, it was Marvin Scott from Channel 5 news team. He was the anchor man at the time. And he had been involved with a haunting that we had investigated in Bloomfield, New Jersey. And he was impressed by this. So he gave us a ring and he said, we'd like you to come down and see what's going on in Amityville, Long Island. Now, this was not the Amityville horror case at that time, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
This was just another haunted house, and we didn't even realize that six people had been murdered in that house of the Fayol family.
Okay, Lorraine, I know you went in the house and you experienced things, mm-hmm. but can we just go over how you first were called into the house? Like, who was the gentleman that, or people that called you in? Was it the Lutzes that called you in?
No, it was not, Tony. It was Marvin Scott who called us in. He told us there had been a tragedy in that home. He didn't go into detail regarding it. He told us that it was a prominent family. He also told us during that very first conversation that the family that were living there at the present time had fled and left all of their possessions behind. And their viewers were very interested of the history of that house and what exactly might be wrong with the home. That's how we first became involved.
A few years ago, I had seen a documentary about Amityville with Marvin Scott discussing the Amityville Halloween special that he had done. I contacted him, and he explained, just as he had in the show, that there was little to tell. He had taken a film crew and some paranormal investigators into the Amityville home to do a seance near Halloween, and it was a big flop. Nothing happened of interest. But Lorraine Warren did ask to go to a separate seance upstairs, and while Marvin and his crew left disappointed, Lorraine and Ed left with a legend that would stay with them for the rest of their lives.
Whatever it was the Lutzes believed was in that house, it did not manifest itself the night I spent in the house 23 years ago with a group of parapsychologists who conducted a seance. The demonic force was supposedly the strongest in the sewing room, where Lorraine Warren conducted another seance by candlelight. Other than a brief chill, after all, it was February, I felt nothing unusual.
But it did to me, Marvin, because I said to you, Marvin, I hope this is as close to hell as I'll ever get.
Not I. The only persistent voice I heard that night was that of my crew, wanting to know when we were going to have the sandwiches we had brought along.
Now let's get to Joe Nickel. He just finished up a very thorough investigation into the case behind The Conjuring, and the write-up of that will be in an upcoming Skeptical Inquirer magazine. I talked to Joe about his involvement with this case and with the Warrens, and it goes back a while, but I'll let him tell you all about it.
Monster Talk.
When did you first become aware of the Warrens and their work?
Well, I really got them firsthand back in the days of The Haunting in Connecticut, the first version of that with the Snedekers.
Yeah.
The case that made Sally Jesse Raphael just in time for Halloween. And I was on with the Snedekers and with Ed and Lorraine, and it left a very bad taste in my mouth. Ed Warren was a bullying type and a backstage, a loudmouth swearing sailor, and not, in my opinion, a nice guy. He made veiled threats to me on the Sally show, sort of under his breath, and I turned to him at one point and I said, "Are you threatening me?" And, of course, they cut all that out of the tape.
Joe, you say the investigations the Warrens conducted is baloney. Why?
Well, I've investigated haunted houses for some 20 years, and a professional psychologist... Pardon?
Is there such a thing?
I've not met a house that I thought was haunted. I think the Warrens have never met a house that they didn't think was haunted.
I think that you are mistaken.
It's my turn.
You made a statement.
I've heard that you were loudmouthed. You shouted people down. Just give me my chance to talk.
No, I won't give you a chance.
You did that to me last show we were on.
Say a bunch of lies.
Joe, I'll give you your chance.
We have the proof.
You're a loudmouth, Warren, and we all know it, but if you'll just let me finish.
When you're concerned, I'm a loudmouth.
Go ahead, Joe.
Try to show a little
Joe,
class.
I don't have a lot of time.
No, I'm not going to give class to somebody who's sitting here. You'll have nothing but lying.
Ed, let Joe just explain.
Be careful who you call a liar.
Well, what would you do about it?
Guys, Joe, point by point.
Yes, one thing, that the houses that sincere people report that they think are haunted usually follow certain patterns. This is a hodgepodge of the sort of ghost tale, poltergeist, part demon, part this, part that.
Were you there?
We saw a similar pattern with the Amityville Horror, a case that the Warrens thought was genuine.
We didn't think.
It turned out to be a blatant
Nobody
hoax.
Nobody ever proved that.
Concocted over several bottles of wine.
Can
the
you
evidence.
Prove it?
Yes, I can
no,
prove it. Yes,
you
I can.
Prove
it's
it.
Been proven.
No, it has never
the
been proven.
The evidence is very clear in the case of the Amityville Horror.
No,
the whole
no
packaging
way.
Of this story. The
packaging.
Book says it's for Halloween release. The book was written by a professional fiction writer who writes horror stories.
Joe,
this whole packaging is a crock.
Joe, does the church admit to exorcism?
He's an
according
atheist. How
to,
would he know?
According to a newspaper article that I have, the Bridgeport newspaper, the diocese refuses to confirm that they had any exorcism there.
If there was an exorcism,
I don't understand why there is any reason why they can't come out and say so.
We've had priests on the show when we've talked about exorcism.
If I can prove that there wasn't exorcism.
After the show, I went outside, and Ed Warren was sitting in the limo to go back to the airport, and he had the car door open, and I walked right up to him, and I said, you were going to do what to me? And he looked, you know, frightened, and I leaned in, and I said, you know, Ed, you're a tough guy. You're tough around the mouth, and walked off.
The whole episode's available on YouTube right now, so I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Okay.
And so the Haunting of Connecticut case, we'd actually talked about in a previous episode. We got Ray Garton, the author who wrote the novel about that, on. And I had actually run into him on a message board where he had spoken very disparagingly about the whole experience of writing that book, and that he hated the fact that it had been written based on a true story motif. And and so I didn't know if that was really him or not, and I tracked him down and got him to come on and talk about it. And so I'm going to put a little bit of that in this episode as well.
I understand he had trouble because he thought the Snedekers kept changing their story, for one thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not sure if he was saying that the Warrens were encouraging, but one of the ghostwriters was saying that they would encourage him to sort of make up stuff, or, you know, improvise with scary elements.
I'm going to clip a little bit of that audio.
I went to Connecticut and I met with Ed and Lorraine Warren and Alan Carmen Snedeker, the couple who had lived in the former funeral parlor, the house that used to be a funeral parlor. And I recorded our conversations. I had quite a few tapes, and I couldn't get the Snedekers, their stories, the details of their stories weren't meshing. They weren't adding up. And so I went to Ed Warren and I explained to him that this was happening, you know, and I said, I'm not sure how to go about this. I had never done any nonfiction before, so this was a new experience for me, and I wanted to have all the information laid out in chronological order in front of me, and it just wasn't adding up. So I told Ed, and he said, well, they're crazy. He said, all the people who come to us are crazy. That's why they come to us. He said, you just use what you can and make the rest up. He said, that's why we hired you. You're a horror writer. You write scary books. We want this to be a good story, and we want it to be scary.
Because I think that's really important to understand that about what the Warrens were up to. You know, it's one thing to be very, very misguided, which of course they were, but that alone does not make someone odious, perhaps. But when you're misguided and not honest, then you're it's hard to find, for me to find a redeeming quality.
Did you have a chance to see The Conjuring?
Yes, I've not only seen The Conjuring, but I've read both of the available two books of a trilogy by Andrea Perrin, so I deserve some kind of medal. There were several things. The Warrens did come there, and the father, Roger, didn't know that they were coming. They didn't invite them. The Warrens just showed up one day. So that's really quite different from the way the movie has them being sought out as this famous duo and so forth, that they begged them to come and help them. No, they just showed up sometime before, I think it was again before Halloween. Which shows a whole lot, I think, about what they're up to. Most of their work was done around Halloween, it looks like. And they tried to ingratiate themselves, and then Carolyn Perrin, the mother, did kind of buy into the Warrens, while her husband kept saying, you know, these people are charlatans and this whole approach is just nothing better than a kind of fraud and a bunch of silliness, and he wanted no part of it. But she was very intent, and so she invited them for the famous sort of exorcism, which was originally billed as just a cleansing of the house or a seance. And they showed up. So Roger was not happy. He was pretty much at outs with the whole operation. So he was not sitting in the circle of the seance. And so at some point, she scoots back in her chair and falls over. This, of course, is in the movie, is made that the chair levitates and turns completely upside down.
Yeah.
So it just to kind of compare. Well, so her husband rushes over to help her, and Ed Warren tries to restrain him, whereupon, in one of the great moments of skepticism, he decked Warren, hit him right in the nose. It bloodied his nose.
Wow.
And I thought back to Sally Jesse Raphael when I read that, and I thought, that could have been me. But you know, so you just realize these things that you might have done, and someone else did it. So, but seriously,
yeah.
that's what happened. And
in the books, since I have not had the opportunity to read that, is that the right word? Anyway, I haven't read those books.
Right. I mean, a thousand pages, about $50 worth of books. The things I do for the cause of skepticism.
And it's appreciated, I assure you. Do you know...
Somebody had to read them.
Yeah. And now these are self-published. And I think one of the things that really made me not want to read them, besides the Amazon reviews, was the fact
The trouble is, though, in not wanting to, is that they nevertheless are the most authoritative is not the right word.
The closest to a primary source.
The closest to a primary source. That's right. And even at that, it's pretty pathetic, because she's writing 30 some years after the fact.
Right.
This is not recorded, or you know. Now there were allegedly some notes her mother made and some sketches and so forth, but she gave those to Lorraine Warren with the understanding that, you know, there were a couple of understandings. One was that they were sort of talking to them confidentially. And secondly, that they, you know, she was lending these notes. At least that's the way it's presented in the books. And, of course, she didn't understand the Warrens. So, of course, there's never to this day has anyone gotten them back, if the Warrens even, you know, if Lorraine, Ed's dead, but if Lorraine even knows where they are. And as to the confidentiality, of course, the first thing they know is that people are coming to their house, sort of like happened at Amityville. People are coming to their house sort of wanting to see the ghosts, you know. Carolyn Perrin was wondering, well, where are these people coming from, you know, and well, how do they know about our rural isolated farmhouse? Well, the Warrens were giving public lectures and telling people right where they were.
Wow.
And so they were.
And I should interject here that if anyone listening to the show is interested in looking at the house, please don't, because the current owners are already suffering from a tremendous amount of harassment because of the publicity from this film.
I'm not surprised. You know, to mention another house that the Warrens were connected with, and there were several, the Smurls house in West Pittston and Amityville and others. The Amityville house, I knew Barbara Cromarty, who lived in the house with her husband after the famous brouhaha created by the Lutzes and the book and movie. And you know, eventually the Cromartys sued on the grounds that their you know, they bought the house in good faith, and it turned out that it was all these false stories, as it turned out, matter really of judicial record in the trials that were held, the lawsuits that were heard, and there was no truth to the Amityville story. It was all made up as the attorney William Weber, who was the attorney for
was it Ronnie DeFeo?
Ronald DeFeo, who's known as Butch. Butch had Weber as his defense attorney, and Weber was trying to think of some angle to get him a new trial, you know, because he had murdered his entire family, siblings and parents in that house. And so Weber thought that if people believed he was driven to this by demon possession or something, he might get some, you know, a new look at the case. And Weber has, you know, publicly confessed that that story was made up with him and George and Kathy Lutz in his law office over, as he put it, several bottles of wine that George was drinking. So that's another case. And the point there is that, you know, people would be knocking on the Cromarty's door wanting to come in and look around and see the ghost. People were milling about in the yard. And as I say, I got to know her, and we had had some interesting conversations. And a TV show wanted to get in there and film, and she explained to me, you know, very, very nice to me. She said, "Look, Joe, I can't let anybody in, because if I do, then, you know, we'll undermine our lawsuit. You can't complain that people are bothering you coming to the door and wanting to come in, and at the same time let a TV crew in."
Right.
It's sort of contradictory, and I understood that.
After the book, there were a lot of the Amityville book, I mean, there were a lot of really important inconsistencies that were just, I mean, physically obvious things that could not have been true.
Well, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I went over some of those with Barbara Cromarty. For example, they mentioned in the book that there were devil's tracks in the snow at a certain point. And pretty simple research showed that there was no snow on the ground at that time.
It was a demon snow.
Well, you know, you could do a book. There's a chapter right there. and explain these otherwise perplexing paranormal mysteries.
Yeah.
But that was one example. But where Barbara was concerned, the book claimed that, you know, a door was ripped off its hinges and windows were ripped open and so forth. And in fact, as she assured me, and then later a TV, after the dust had settled and everything, she was willing to let a TV crew in. And I didn't get to go, but they picked my brains and I put them in touch with her, and she took them around the house and showed them a number of the inconsistencies and how things were exaggerated. And one of them was that the doors and windows all had the original old hardware and the old varnish all in evidence. And they got, you know, close-up shots of that and everything. That nothing had been replaced. No locksmiths had ever been called to the house. In fact, the police hadn't been called to the house. So really, it was just a travesty, the Amityville case, which is really the Amityville hoax.
And it seems to be a pattern with the Warrens that their most popular or well-known cases are sort of plagued with these, what would you call them, reality-based inconsistencies? Is that a polite way of
putting it? Yes, yes. Now, the Warrens didn't have as much really to do with Amityville as they might have liked to, because, you know, they didn't do one of their famous books. That went to somebody else, and they were kind of not famous enough at the time or something. But they did, they had been involved in Amityville, and they went on, as I mentioned, to some of these other houses. And there's a pattern. I've written about this. The Warren's modus operandi, as I call it, is this. And you have to understand that the Warrens are this sort of, were this couple of, I think of as medieval-minded Catholics, unlike modern and often very enlightened Catholics. They believe literally in demons, and Ed fancied himself, had a business card that said Ed Warren, demonologist. And Lorraine was, you know, acclaimed clairvoyant, but wasn't clairvoyant at all, as far as I can tell. And they had this medieval notion of demons, and they had gotten into ghost hunting. Ed was an artist, amateur artist, and he would make paintings of haunted houses and then use those to kind of get in with the people in the house and begin his sort of career. And what they did was to, eventually, the cases that ended up as books, they would show up and try to convince the people that they were experts. They knew all about everything. And they had some, you know, ghost hunting equipment like cameras and an ultraviolet light and some holy water and a crucifix, just what you need, you know, if you're going to investigate ghosts. And they would go in and take a case that, for all intents and purposes, had thus far been in the news as pretty much a ghost case or maybe a poltergeist case, something like that. Not too much about demonic forces. And the next thing you know, the Warrens have convinced everybody that there are demons involved. Lorraine would go into one of her light trances, which just would mean she would just close her eyes and haul off and say something. And she would sense some demonic presence. And the two of them would talk a good talk about this. And you see these poor, unsuspecting people who, first of all, don't know anything about the paranormal, and not aware that you know, there are no haunted places, only haunted people, as Robert Baker used to say. And so when you have someone who's an expert explaining to them, you know, that there are these different kinds of spirits and this and that and the other, they don't know any better. They think maybe these people know what they're talking about. And so it's interesting that in every case of this, these were Catholic families. And Ed and Lorraine would show up and convince them that it was really demonic and that they really needed to use their, you know, Catholic powers of exorcism and holy water and so forth. And they would convert it into a demonic book, and then they would get a ghostwriter, and all of the shenanigans would be sort of restyled and exaggerated and spooky elements thrown in.
They would punch it up, as we say.
Punch it up. That's right. They would punch it up. And this is for the books. And then, of course, by the time Hollywood got it, I mean, we're talking really punched up.
Yeah.
When a chair scooted backwards ends up, you know, turning upside down and hanging in the air upside down, which is pretty punched up.
As a skeptical paranormal investigator, how excited would you be to see a levitation or something like that happens in the films?
Well, I just would love to do it.
I know.
I mean, it just, there's nothing that would thrill me more. I remember once talking to a young lady many, many years ago who had been, taken in by the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi group. You know, the transcendental, the transcendental meditation people. And sadly, my good friend, Doug Henning, the magician, the very talented young magician who died young, and he was taken in by this. And you know, Doug was well known as a TMer, and he would go on TV and levitate people. James Randi chastised him because obviously Doug was using the magic trick version of this on stage, and he wasn't deliberately trying to be deceptive, but it just, you know, a lot of people didn't understand. Mm-hmm. Here's a guy who believes in TM, and they teach levitation, and, well, here he is on TV levitating someone, you know. If you don't really make clear that, yes, but this is a trick, and so on. But I remember telling this young lady that I doubted that anyone could levitate, that there was this thing called the, you know, the law of gravity. And she began to berate me about how closed-minded I was and how pitiful science was, and science didn't know everything, and, you know, the usual claptrap, all very emotionally presented. And I said, well, no, wait a minute, stop. I said, let me tell you how really open-minded I am. I am willing, because she was telling me she knew this guy, this guru, that could levitate. And I said, have you seen him? No, but he wouldn't lie to me, she said.
Wow.
And I said, well, but, okay, so let me tell you how really open-minded I am. I will go any place and meet any reasonable conditions for him to show me this. And of course, immediately the barriers went up. Well, nobody has to prove anything to you. And I said, wait. I'm not at this point just anybody. I'm somebody who's written on this and made a lot of TV shows, and I'm someone that I can tell you a lot of people would pay attention to if I said, okay, I've really seen this. Andrea Perrin thinks that her mother's chair lifted up or something, but as best I can tell, if you subtract 30-some years of exaggeration and brouhaha and the power of suggestion and so forth, basically her chair slid back and snagged on something or whatever, certain physical laws come to mind here, and tipped backward. Basically, you know how when you go to a Pentecostal service or one of the televangelist services where they demonstrate going under power, and the evangelist is there and the people are, you know, getting ready to go into the power, and you can watch some of them, you know, sort of getting into the role, and then they're pointed at or touched or something, and they fall back. There's usually a catcher.
Yeah, I would actually encourage listeners to seek out the documentary Marjoe, Marjoe.
And yes, Marjoe, yeah, which won a standing ovation at Cannes way back in the 70s.
Yeah.
She has an excellent, excellent movie, and he shows that, and he shows how to give him a push if you need to.
Yes.
And which happened to me. I was at one service, curiously enough, at a Catholic church, which doesn't usually do that, but they had a visiting charismatic Catholic who did that, and I had talked to the guy, and he invited me to the service. I had no idea who I was, of course. And I decided to just stand there, you know, pretty rigid. And it was kind of funny. He was so determined I was going to go. He gave me a real push on the forehead, and at some point, you know, it's hard to not to go down or step back, and the catcher caught me.
Wow, yeah. So
my wife caught it on film. It's a blurred picture, but it's priceless.
Wow.
But I think that the same psychology of that, which is very much like stage, and those people you find will be compliant, and if you ask them to do something and tell them they can't do this or whatever, they will probably go along with you. And that you may lead them into a kind of dissociative state, but they're basically, you know, doing what's expected of them. And certainly these people who fall into the power, they know they're supposed to fall down. No two do it the same way, because there's no set way you have to do it. Some will stiffen and fall straight back. Some will slump. Some will fall down and twitch and so on. Kind of like when you were a kid and someone said, bang, bang, you're dead.
Yeah.
There were several ways to act.
Right.
Everybody
said, suddenly you just become quite dramatic based on your own information.
Yeah, we each had our own style. You know, we could pitch forward or fall backward or you know, twitch or our eyes would we fall with our eyes open or whatever.
Well, and I don't want to sound like a cynic, but I suspect the same thing is going on with Bob Larson's demonology courses. It's, you know,
well, exactly. Yeah. I think that's where I'm getting to is that that's at the root of all of this stuff, and I think that's what happened with Mrs. Perrin in the books that her daughter has written. And anyway, one can read my analysis, but I go into, you know, pretty much all of the phenomena.
Yeah.
And my assessment is a little less supernatural.
Right. And I would suspect that most listeners would probably think that kind of, let's call it stage possession, is relatively harmless, but I think what I've seen is maybe not, because a lot of people, and I say a lot, enough that it's troubling throughout the world, are conducting exorcisms against unwilling victims. And that's where it really seems to be quite dangerous, and people get hurt or die from the experience of the exorcism.
Exactly. And even the most... You know, when you tell people that they're possessed, or you put them through some supernatural business, you're really, you're changing their lives in all kinds of ways. For example, you're telling them that there's this invisible supernatural realm that is controlling things, and science can't find this realm, and you know, those of us who I've done this work, paranormal investigative work, now for over 40 years, and I increasingly am convinced that we live in a real, natural world. I've found no evidence at all for anything supernatural. And so, if I did, I would obviously be life-changing, life-transforming. And that's what happens to people. They get caught up in cults and fringe groups and so forth, in which they become increasingly seduced by, you know, invisible forces, demons, and so forth. And it's not healthy.
No, I agree.
It's not harmless. The people who think, oh well, but if the person's chronic drinker, and you convince him that it's devils that are making him do it, and you exorcise the devils, and maybe you can trick him into quitting drinking. Well, I just don't think that's okay. I mean, I think that takes paternalism to a kind of fascistic degree, and I don't like that idea that it's okay to fool the little people. I personally don't know any little people. Being an equalitarian, I think people are people, and they don't need to be treated like, well, we'll humor them and convince them that some demon did this and their guardian angel is going to do that and so forth. No, I don't think that's helpful or healthy to do.
Yeah, and I would say that if you're in a position where you feel like you're experiencing a supernatural event, it would be really helpful to go to someone who's not in, I guess, to someone who's in an out group, you know, someone who's not mm-hmm. experiencing these things, because I think you can get into a reinforcement loop where if ghost hunters, I think, have this problem. If you go ghost hunting and you only talk to ghost hunters, you never talk to anybody who might be have a differing opinion, then you're only going to get reinforcing feedback.
Right, and there are ghost hunters who would not even talk to a guy like me. You're very
now. I've had that problem too. I find it really disappointing, because I'm very interested. I mean, what could be more exciting than evidence of life after death or continued existence after death? I think it would be wonderful.
Oh, absolutely. If we're this is the thing, we've talked about this before, but the paranormal offers all these great promises that if ghosts are real, then we don't really die. And if flying saucers are real, then we are not alone in the universe, and so on. If psychics are real, we might get a glimpse of something in our future that we could avoid. So, of course, if we were voting, we'd probably all vote for these things. But we, you know, in science, we are not voting, and that's not how we decide.
Right.
But I understand. It's, you know, people. A lot of people think that skeptics somehow just don't want to believe in all kinds of things, and no, they're most skeptics as well would vote. It's just that they've wised up. And they've learned a thing or two. For example, that professional wrestling is fake.
What?
I hate to bring that up, you know, in front of your audience, who I'm sure is, you know, a bunch of innocents.
Just, you're supposed to say spoiler alert, Joe. You say spoiler alert.
Yeah. But pretty soon you realize that, gee, wouldn't it be nice, as Carl Sagan, I remember Carl Sagan saying this. I was there when he said it, that he wished... He wished he could talk to his dead parents, even, as he put it, just once a year to tell them how the grandkids are.
Aww.
That kind of, you know, that kind of feeling. And those feelings are powerful. I've felt them in myself, you know, wishing. I remember when my grandmother died and how much I did not want that to be the case. And I think most of us have some feelings and experiences like that where, no, we wouldn't be against communicating with our dead loved ones. Not an idea we're innately hostile to. In fact, we've had to protect ourselves from the tendency to be seduced by charlatans on these fronts.
Yes. I think going back to the Conjuring case, the Perrin family, when you read the book or the books, did you see anything in the books that led you to believe there might be something that could be investigated at this point, or is the whole case primarily just anecdotal at this point?
Well, I treated it, the account, as here's an account that one can respond to, and I have done that. I don't want to say too much
sure.
about my approach, but one can look at it. It's pretty much what you can do with a cold case. People are at this stage, you know, dead. Some of them, the principals are, if you could have gotten to them 30 years ago, you might have been able to do something, but now the positions they take are entrenched and they've got maybe exaggerated views of things that happened, so on. But I think it's still possible to suggest, based on things they say, some things that you can explain pretty much on their own terms. But
well, I would say that in the film, they did a lot of the kind of things that I really, I'll say, disdain about a lot of ghost investigations, which is they felt like paranormal things were going on, so they apparently went and looked to see who had died there.
It's just straight out of the formula of the idea that, I mean, you're almost expecting them to try to prove that there was... The house was built on an Indian burial ground.
Right.
You know, there are certain sort of stock motifs, and you know what they are, and so you go looking for them. It's a kind of you're engaging in confirmation bias big time that way.
Exactly.
You get some paranormal things going, and then you jump to try to confirm it. You know, people died here. Right, they die everywhere.
They do. I've noticed that.
up and down every street and in, you know, suburban homes and so forth.
Monster Talk.
Steve Novella and his group, the New England Skeptic Society, also met and investigated the Warrens. Their interaction wasn't as hostile as Joe Nichols, but it's just as interesting. How did you hear about the Warrens for the first time? Do you remember when you first heard about them and their work?
No, I don't remember when I first heard about them, because they were already locally famous before we started the Connecticut Skeptical Society, which soon, you know, very quickly transformed into the New England Skeptical Society. They were locally famous people. You know, I always knew about the Warrens. You know what I mean? I don't remember the moment when I became aware of them.
Wow! So they had already been operating for a while.
40 years. before we got involved. Yeah.
Wow.
And right in Connecticut, right in, like, you know, literally down the road from us, you know, a couple towns over. So yeah, we absolutely knew who they were.
So was it, let's talk about the nest. So like you had a group of friends who formed, the Connecticut Skeptic Society, you said?
Yeah, that at first, and then we realized there were no other ones in New England, so we might as well just be the New England Skeptical Society. Well,
could you talk about that? Because I think you mentioned that a long time ago in your podcast, where you talked about looking in the back of the magazines. And...
Yeah, it was actually Perry. You know, Perry, you know, always liked to take credit for that. We became friends, and then both realized that we were both skeptics, and we both read the Skeptical Inquirer. And, you know, Perry was over my house one day and he shows me the back of the Skeptical Inquirer where all the local groups are. He's like, you notice anything? There's no group in Connecticut. He's like, we should do that. You and I should form the Connecticut Skeptical Society. And as soon as he said it, I knew it was a perfect idea. You know, of course we should do that. So we did it. You know, we got my brother Bob involved, our friend, mutual friend Evan, you know, now, of course, are on the podcast with us. Jay wasn't involved in those early days. He got involved a little bit later. And we, you know, we just started doing the things that local skeptical groups do, doing local investigations, you know, writing a newsletter, holding local lectures, trying to get plugged into the big national group, which at that time basically was PsyCop. That was really the only game in town. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. We really cut our teeth on a lot of really interesting local investigations.
So I'm trying to picture this. How old were you in this? Like, is this college?
No. This was 1996. So I was like just finishing my residency.
Oh wow, that's actually wow. Okay, that I didn't realize that was this recent. Okay, so how did you decide that? How did you pick your investigations there locally?
Whatever came our way, you know, we weren't that discriminating. And once we got a little bit of credibility and got our name out, then some started coming to us, which is always nice. But, you know, the Warrens, you know, was interesting because for us, they were the big fish, right? They were the most famous paranormal proponents in our region. And they were a little intimidating to us, you know. We really thought, oh, God, we really got to make sure we're prepared and really, you know, get some experience and know what we're talking about before we take them on. Because they're going to be, you know, they know what they're doing. They're going to be, you know, difficult to really do a good job. And we totally overestimated them.
What were they famous for? What did they do? I mean,
They spawned many ghost investigating groups. Their biggest claim to fame was the Amityville Horror case. They had already by that time been the subject of movies. Any local ghost story had their name attached to it.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. They investigated thousands of cases. So they pretty much had their hands in any local ghost hunting, ghost story situation.
So you decide to investigate the Warrens. How did you reach out to them and make arrangements to do that?
I don't remember the details. I think we just called them up, you know, or Perry used to do stuff like that a lot. So we just called them up, said, hey, you know, this is who we are. We want to see what you got, you know. So I remember the first meeting very well. I don't know if you want to just dive right into that.
Yeah, let's talk. Yeah.
So first meeting, what we went over to their house, which apparently they often had people over. They had a museum in their basement. And so they would frequently invite people into their house, bring them down to their basement, show them all the artifacts that they had collected over the years.
I just saw a documentary about that called The Conjuring. It was very scary down there.
Yeah, right. we had a blast doing this because there we are. So get this, you know, just imagine this old couple, you know, Ed and Lorraine Warren. By this time, they were already in their 70s. And, you know, they were, or maybe they were at that time, they were in their 60s. And they were clueless. I mean, again, we had built them up in our heads because we, you know, you watch a movie about the Warrens and they're presented as like serious researchers who actually know what they're doing. And then you meet them, you're like, oh my God, Ed is just a gavone. I mean, the guy had no idea what he was doing, didn't know the first thing about really anything relevant to paranormal investigation or ghost phenomenon, or had just totally unprepared for any question that we had to ask him. And he desperately wanted the validation of scientific investigation. He wanted us to validate his claims and his evidence, which was interesting. We quickly picked up on that. It's like, wow, this guy's actually desperate for our validation. Lorraine, you know, who's still around, is a self-proclaimed clairvoyant, and so she was much more, what's the word? I mean, she was just way out there. Both of them extremely, extremely religious, and of course, all of us are atheists. And like right away, it's, do you guys believe in God? That's like they want to know that right off the bat. And so many inside jokes came from that meeting.
Lorraine, I mean, even now, if I listen to interviews, she always starts off with, if you don't believe in God, you know, you really are in a hopeless situation in the paranormal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So at one point, she asked us, so what was it? Why are you atheists? What went wrong? Was it the science thing? Yeah, Lorraine, it was the science thing. That's what drove us from God.
Yeah.
But you know, they were just, otherwise they were just like your grandparents, you know, they were just a regular old couple. This is what they did for a living. They went around giving lectures at colleges and, you know, they had classes where they told ghost stories, you know, that was it.
That doesn't seem like a very steady income.
No, they did it good for themselves. You know, they were on the college circuit, you know, they got thousands of dollars. Oh yeah. They talked probably at every college or university in New England and the Indian area, and they absolutely made a steady income doing that, no problem. So our approach was, you know, we did not confront them on their belief system. That wasn't our purpose there. Our purpose was to investigate their evidence, and that's what we told Ed. We just want to know what, you know, you've been doing this for 40 years. You must have accumulated some evidence after, at that time, he claimed had to have investigated 8,000 cases. So we're like, hit us. Give us your best evidence. Show us. Convince us. We're open-minded. We will believe it. You just show us some, whatever the most compelling evidence you have is. And he was very, you know, very squirrely about the whole thing. And I think he was afraid that we weren't going to validate his evidence. So he showed us a lot of ghost photos, which, if you've ever just gone on the web and look up ghost photos, you've seen them. You know, it's all the same things. It's basically the three, four most common photographic artifacts. And you get some flashbacks, some camera cord effect, occasional double exposure, all very unimpressive, just blobs of light on film. When we wrote about our experience with them, we had a section on the photographic artifacts, because that is their 99% of their evidence. It's just ghost photos. And they made absolutely no attempt to rule out artifacts, to understand the nature of the evidence. Here's an example of the level of sophistication that we were dealing with. On their website, they had a section where they described how to take a ghost photograph. Now, they claim that the ghostly images get on the film psychically. The ghosts, like, psychically project the images onto the film. But they were surprised to find that happened more often when you used a flash. And the brighter the flash, the better. And yet, it didn't occur to them that the flash was producing the effect, that was producing the light on the film. They still thought it was a psychic effect from the ghosts, or at least that's what they professed to believe. So that's what we were dealing with. We pointed that out to them, and they just sort of quietly took that off their website without ever acknowledging our correction. But that's basically what we were dealing with.
Wow.
So, but other than that, they seemed like nice people.
They did. It was fun hanging out with them. They were nice people. You know, at least at that stage, you know, once we wrote our article and, like, Ed no longer had any, you know, delusion of convincing us about anything, he did get a little nasty on a couple occasions. So Perry and I were on a local TV show with Ed Warren and somebody who was working with him at the time. And, he was kind of a jerk on that show. He did a typical thing where he sort of dropped new evidence on us that we had never seen before. It's like, explain that, skeptics. It's like, you know, Ed, we've been asking you for evidence. Now it had been a couple of years. We've been asking you for evidence for the couple of years. We've never seen that before. We'd be happy to take a look at it if you're willing to give us the evidence now to evaluate. Because he would never put evidence in our hands to investigate. He would only show it to us. And we wrote about the two big pieces of evidence. So Ed claimed that his best single piece of evidence was a video of the white lady at Union Cemetery. And as we described it, it was at that perfect distance and resolution that it was suggestive of a ghostly figure. But you couldn't really see it well enough to know that it wasn't Lorraine in a bedsheet. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, right? It just wasn't close up. It wasn't in focus enough. The quality was not there. So it was like if you were trying to fake a ghost video, that's exactly what it would have looked like. The other piece of evidence, which actually was Ed did not own, it was actually owned by somebody who was investigating with him, and that's how we got our hands on it. So again, Ed never gave us a single piece of evidence to actually investigate, but somebody who went on an investigation with him did. And this was, you know, now the infamous video of the kid that disappeared.
You mean teleports? So,
yeah, well... teleported, he dematerialized was the term that.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, but they're investigating a haunted house. There's a lot of students with them. And, you know, when they didn't notice anything unusual during the investigation. But the next day, when they're looking at now this is like a VHS tape, right, that we're talking about. At one point, one of the students was standing in a doorway. He like puts his hand on his head and looks up. Something had dripped on top of his head. And then he disappears. And he's gone from the tape. Now, a three-year-old looking at this would say the tape stopped and then was restarted later when the kid wasn't there. That's the obvious sort of hypothesis.
Yeah, I would posit that it might take a six-year-old. But yeah, I'm with you.
Maybe six-year-old. No, I think my three-year-old.
Well, your three-year-old's exceptional. My six-year-olds are still kind of amazed by that. So.
Yeah, so the in persistence thing. When do kids figure that out?
I don't know. I'm just kidding. So
yeah, I know. But so is it fine? All right, you know, I said, I know. Are you sure that the camera wasn't stopped? I mean, because that's the first thing that occurs to me when you look at that. And you go, we are absolutely sure nobody was anywhere near that camera. It didn't stop. That kid disappeared. That was Ed's famous line. Okay, can we look at the tape? Yes, he gave us the tape. We didn't touch it. We handed it directly over to a technician, somebody from HB Group, which, you know, they have video equipment and do this sort of thing. They had an editing deck. Now, with the old VHS tapes, once you know the technology, then you can make sense of the investigation. So, first of all, the editing deck, that you can view information around the edge of the picture that you wouldn't see on your TV. And when you look at the tape on an editing deck, you could see that there was someone standing right next to the camera, despite the fact that they insisted there was nobody anywhere near it. So that was just flat out proven factually wrong. Next, you can, you know, pretty much prove that the tape was stopped and restarted. And that's because the way these tapes worked is the images were scanned line by line across each frame from top to bottom, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, because that's, you have the spinning head and it's just scanning the lines very, very quickly, however many, you know, lines there were per second. So if someone actually disappeared, what would have happened in the middle of that scanning process? It wouldn't have happened at the end of the last swipe on one frame and prior to the first swipe on the next frame. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Yeah, the chances of that happening would be, you know, minuscule, that it happened at that perfect moment, that it was right, you know, it almost certainly would have occurred while one frame was being swiped. And it didn't. The kid was completely there on one image and completely gone on the next. Really, the only way to make that happen is to stop the tape and restart it. But then further, I mean, this is like total overkill. There were multiple discontinuities right at the same moment, audio and video discontinuities, like footfalls with echoes that abruptly stop right at that frame, mm-hmm. and also a flickering candle that shifts right at that frame. So you could, multiple independent lines of evidence showed that there was a discontinuity right when the kid vanished from the film, and it was completely in between two images, not while an image was being rendered. So there we go. The analysis pretty conclusively proves that the tape was stopped or restarted.
Did they ever find that child, Steve?
The guy, nothing. That's the interesting thing. The kid said nothing unusual happened. He didn't disappear, and he remembers nothing unusual from that whole evening. Again, nobody did. It was only noticed when they viewed the tape, which is a red flag for a photographic artifact. Yeah. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. It was just something that appeared on the video. So it has to do something with the video. So anyway, total overkill proves that that's what happened. The most simple thing is, in fact, what all the evidence points to. They never accepted it. They never accepted that conclusion. They insisted that kid dematerialized. Just immune to evidence and reason. They knew what they were looking for.
Yeah. I think that's one of the big challenges, that most people don't know the details of the real investigations. They're only familiar with the fictionalized versions.
Yeah, and exactly.
So I had a lot of issues with this after I became just openly a skeptic. When I was younger, is that story true? Is that story true? I would investigate, see what I could find out. And a lot of things converged to get me where I'm at right now. But the Amityville Horror in particular was one that used to scare me a lot. And now I don't find it frightening at all. And I wonder, I understand that The Conjuring is doing quite well, but I don't think there's been any really great takedowns of the backstory. Or not that there necessarily needs to be a takedown per se, but it's heavily fictionalized. I mean, even compared to what the actual people reported, at least
the Perrin family.
Yeah. And so did you see the film?
Not yet. No, I will go out to see it. We're going to probably review it on our show too, but we haven't had a chance to see it yet. We just got through filming our web series. So that's kept us busy. But, like the Amityville Horror, you have a absolutely fictionalized version of events. And although in this case, with the Amityville Horror, there was an admission that it was all made up. In this case, the family claims that, that's pretty much what happened. We were haunted. Although it was over in the movie, it's over a very short period of time. In real life, they were in that house for 9 years, something like 9 years.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. And when asked, for example, why did you stay in the house if there were apparitions of rotting flesh walking around? And the answer was very unsatisfying. The daughter, who was the youngest person at the time, said, I guess it's just our destiny to tell this story to the world. That doesn't really answer the question, does it? And she ends, I've read some interviews with her where she says, hey, I know what we experienced. And of course, no, you don't. You really don't know what you experienced. You have a constructed perception leading to a constructed memory and reconstructed memory over and over again. Whatever's going on in your head right now of events that happened 30 plus years ago, 40 years ago, is a complete confabulation and fiction without necessarily any relationship to reality. But in her mind, that story really happened,
I know, but to really enjoy the film, I have to suspend my materialist dogma and have some popcorn and a soda.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I love a good ghost story. I'm sure I'll enjoy the movie as a good horror film. I love being creeped out.
Yeah, I'll tell you this. The first third of it is the most effective horror film I've seen in a long time. If you know anything about the Warrens, which you do, having actually met them, you'll find that the on-screen portrayal of them is, I want to say, too goody-two-shoes. Like, they're too good at what they do without any question at all. And so, they're going to succeed in what they do.
It'll probably be hard not to vomit watching their portrayal. Yeah. The
but the first third is rocking good. It's really good. So.
Yeah, that's the thing. Again, same thing with other movies. At least one other movie I saw where the Warrens were depicted, and the stark contrast to reality is jarring. They had the scene where that someone is telling them about their experience. Like, oh, you know, they're not quite sure what's going on yet. The person who's being haunted, they're like, these strange things are happening in my house. And like Ed and Lorraine give each other a knowing look like, oh yeah, we are familiar with this phenomenon, you know? Oh, please. I mean, it really is nothing like them at all. They really were very unsophisticated individuals. And, you know, I have lots of secondhand stories about Ed, because once we started investigating the Warrens, that investigation took us to a lot of people who used to work with the Warrens and then broke off. Again, the Warrens over the previous decades must have spun off dozens and dozens of independent ghost hunting groups, because this is the cycle. You know, you see Ed and Lorraine talk at a college, give a college lecture, you go up afterwards, and they would tell you, oh, you should come to our classes. You know, they used to give classes at the Carousel restaurant, you know, down the road. And you'd go to the class, you know, so you'd catch, they would go through a process of serial selection until you get the people who are like really into it. And then they would take people on investigations, and then they would figure out a couple of things. One, you know, Ed wasn't the most honest person in the world. And two, that what he did took absolutely no special skill or knowledge. And so they figured, hey, we could do this, and we'll do it right, and we'll do it better, and we'll do it honestly. And so they would just break off and do it on their own. So there was this never-ending cycle of new people coming in and then just very quickly leaving and going off to form their own groups. And so when we talked to them, we talked to many people, disillusioned former colleagues, you know, former students of Ed and Lorraine, and they had a lot of nasty stories to tell about them, which I feel a little uncomfortable talking about because it's all secondhand, you know, so it's essentially hearsay. But I'll just say, you know, we were told, you know, firsthand stories from the people who were investigating with Ed and Lorraine involving, you know, pretty nasty shenanigans.
So many people mentioned like having worked with Ed and Lorraine, and like even the Paranormal State show worked with her for a while. It astonishes me she still has that much cachet at her age with her alleged levels of competency. I don't know, though. On the other hand, she seems like she's probably a really nice lady. I don't I think the thing is there's two parts to that. I tend to like people in general. But at the same time, I think there is they have an undue influence in the paranormal world based on fiction, right?
Yeah. So we tried desperately to have Ed and Lorraine take us on one of their actual investigations, but at the last minute, Ed was talked out of it by some of the people who was working with him, and then he made the excuse that, well, because we were atheists, he couldn't protect us from the entities. And we're like, Ed, listen, we'll take our chances. We know what we're getting into. It's not your responsibility. We'll be fine. Don't worry about us. But, you know, I remember I had that final phone conversation with Ed, like before we were going to write our article. And he was like really worried that because he was bailing on us, that we were going to, again, like do a hit job on him, that we were going to write a very critical article about him. And what he said was, you know, when he finally said, listen, we can't do it. You know, the other guys won't let you guys come on the investigation with us because you're atheists. And I said, yeah, Ed, yeah, this is very disappointing. We're going to have to go with our article without that. And we're going to have to explain that you didn't do that. And I could just hear how crestfallen Ed was, because, again, he still was desperate for our approval at that point. And he said, you're going to make me look like a chump, aren't you?
Oh,
well, I'm going to tell the truth, Ed. I'm going to write it as I see it. But he was, that's being a part of that, you know, him was afraid that we were going to be critical of him and really wanted to please us. But still, you know, hey, he made the decision. You know, if we had gone on an investigation with him, we just would have had more material. It really wouldn't have changed the tone of our article.
Or you would have disappeared and never been seen again.
Yeah, right. We did go on investigations with people who worked with the Warrens, though, just not with Ed Lorraine Warren themselves. And again, they were, you know, And same thing, lots of ghosts. It's all just people with ghost stories. At the end of the day, it's just like watching the ghost hunting shows today. It's just people scaring each other with ghost stories without a shred of credible evidence and without the slightest idea how to do an actual scientific investigation. The difference between a hypothesis and a theory about anomaly hunting, hypothesis testing, they had no clue. They really are, pseudoscientists. They just simply have no idea about how to do an actual scientific investigation. In fact, I gave a lecture for Ed's ghost hunting class where I explained to them what a scientific investigation is and what the kind of evidence it would take to convince us that ghosts are real. And they just didn't get it. They didn't want to get it. They were just having fun. Most people, it's just, this was their fantasy. It really wasn't about, and when I often say, it's like, that's fine. If this is what, we all need to do stuff for fun. If this is your fantasy, if this is for fun, have a good time. Just stop saying you're doing science. Okay. Just stop that. Stop it. Because you're not doing science. That's really the only beef that we have with them, is that they claim that they were gathering scientific evidence when they were making a mockery of the scientific method.
So you think it was a form of LARPing?
Yeah, absolutely. And we often would say that. It's like we say these people need to play tabletop or need to go LARPing.
Yeah.
They need to have some kind of fantasy-based escape that they know is fantasy. The problem is this was their escape, but they were confusing it with reality. We used to say that all the time. These people just went LARPing. They wouldn't have to
do this.
That's
funny. Well, I don't want to spoil the findings of your investigation. We will put a link to that in the show notes.
Sure.
But I did notice that the list of incredibly dangerous arcane tomes in Ed's library included Unearth Arcana.
That museum was hilarious. It was, I don't know where they got all that stuff.
Here's a good example of the kind of research Ed did for his occult museum. In this clip, he's walking an interviewer through his museum of cursed and demonic artifacts. As an FYI, this interviewer here is his son-in-law, Tony Spira, who continues to help out Lorraine to this day, and was also the fellow conducting the interview at the start of this episode. Tony points out a copy of a dark-covered book with a post-it note on it which says, Book of Shadows. And above that, printed on the cover, are the dread words, The Necronomicon.
We head over this way, but while we're heading this way right here, I see this book here. This book, it says Book of Shadows, Necronomicon. Yes. Can you tell me what that is?
Yes, that's one of the original Books of Shadows, which were written in the medieval days. And this one here was translated into English. Just the reading of that book has had terrible results for many people. This is not a book that anyone should ever buy, a Book of Shadows. It goes into the incantations of devils and demons and rituals.
Mm-hmm. Just a modicum of research, and Ed would have learned that the Book of Shadows he's holding is, first of all, not a Book of Shadows, and second of all, not the Necronomicon. This is a copy of the hoax Necronomicon released by the writer known as Simon. It's a famous literary hoax. It's full of incantations and spells that are supposed to be from ancient Sumeria, which are, in fact, not. Also, it's not a Book of Shadows. Book of Shadows are spell books for modern paganism, not ancient medieval scrolls or spells or rituals. His museum of demonic possessed items was full of off-the-shelf Halloween junk, dolls and toys, books you could buy at any bookstore, and in this case, one which wasn't even close to being what he was representing it to be.
But it was like stuff that they thought was demonic or scary or whatever. Again, to put a lot of this into context, Ed and Lorraine were very devout Catholics, and that was their mythology. And so anything that they firmly, Ed called himself a demonologist. That was his approach. These weren't just ghosts. These were demons. His most haunted artifact, according to Ed, was a Raggedy Ann doll, which he kept in a glass case. And before, and again, we were still not sure why he did this, but when he led us down to the basement, then he disappeared for like 10 minutes and then came back. I have no idea what he was doing. I think he was just spying on us. But he warned us, don't go anywhere near the Raggedy Ann doll. Don't touch it. Try not to brush up against anything, because then like you might get possessed, because these things are all so evil. So, of course, we're standing around there touching everything, you know, having a good time and, you know, mocking the Raggedy Ann doll. He told us like a story about the last person who mocked that Raggedy Ann doll died an hour later in a motorcycle accident. Okay, yeah. We're all still around. No problems. But he said, if you do touch anything, let me know, because I'll cleanse your aura by visualizing you in a Christ light. And he'll be able to cleanse us in that way. So, but we never fessed up to having touched anything.
Mm. And the curse is still with you, you're saying?
I guess we're all still cursed, yeah.
So, okay, so what cracks me up about this to no end is the I had heard you tell that story about the doll, and you always called it a Raggedy Ann doll, and I always assumed you were saying that like it was a Xerox, or it was a, you know what I mean, like that was a generic term. And when I went to see the movie, they have this doll Annabelle as part of the story in the beginning, as part of the intro.
Yeah.
And oh, it's super creepy. It's awesome. And then I thought, well, what does the real Annabelle look like? Because I'd heard Steve talk about seeing it. And I went and looked. It's like, oh, my God. No, seriously. It's a Raggedy Ann doll.
No, it is a literal Raggedy Ann doll. Yeah.
And so we were talking. I was talking to my friends about why they changed it. And you know, obviously, copyright issues. Or obviously, a Raggedy Ann doll is not as scary as this creepy thing they use. And I'm like, no, guys. Don't you see? The doll had to be able to pick up stuff, and Raggedy Ann doesn't have fingers.
Right. Right.
That was great. So I'm going to put a picture of that in the show notes too, about the real Annabelle and the one from the film.
Monster Dog.
Well, that's a lot of information about the Warrens. In my research, I also found some interesting articles and videos, and links to those are in the show notes. Be on the lookout for Joe Nichols' research on the Perrin family haunting as depicted in The Conjuring. It'll be in an upcoming issue of Skeptical Inquirer magazine. Also in the show notes is a write-up of the New England Skeptic Society's investigation of the Warrens by Steve Novella and the late Perry DeAngelis. It's a great read. Be sure to check it out. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. I'm Blake Smith, and you've just been listening to our special episode, The Warren Omission. You heard interviews with Joe Nichol, Steve Novella, Marvin Scott, and Ray Garten, and additional audio from Ed and Lorraine Warren and their son-in-law, Tony Spira. If you want to help out Monster Talk, please share this episode with your friends and enemies alike, or frenemies, or enemies. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Skeptic Society or Skeptic Magazine. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys, and thanks again for listening.
Skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.